hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Rethinking Foreign Policy Podcast. I'm Mitchell Putnick, the president of Rethinking Foreign Policy. And in this podcast, I'm going to spend the bulk of the time talking about the recent statements of Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, and specifically the ones about the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions Movement, BDS, some of the thoughts that occurred to me as a result, and some of the things that I think principally we need to do to address that. I'm going to talk about one or two other things first. Before I get into that, I'm just going to remind everyone that you can find all of my work at rethinkingforeignpolicy.org, at least all of my foreign policy work. Some other ideas of mine can be found at crimesmisdemeanors.com. One other point, we're getting closer and closer to 2021. And in February of that year, I will be publishing my first book. Actually, New Press will be publishing my first book, which I co-authored with Mark Lamont Hill. It's called Except for Palestine. And if you go to bookshop.org, you can search either by my name, Mark's name, or look for Except for Palestine. And you can pre-order that book even now as we speak. And I hope you'll do that. Early returns on the book have been great in terms of feedback that we've gotten from some folks who've seen it already. So I'm very excited about it, and I hope that you'll check it out. So before I get to Pompeo, as I mentioned, I have some thoughts on just a couple of other matters that I just want to bring up. And the first one, I think, is going to be a bit controversial to at least some of my listeners. And that is the recent announcement of the signing of the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. That is basically a free trade agreement between a whole bunch of Asian and Pacific countries. And so the countries involved, principally, I mean, the central country is China. The other countries involved who signed the agreement are Australia, Brunei, Cambodia, Indonesia, Japan, Laos, Malaysia, Myanmar, New Zealand, the Philippines, Singapore, South Korea, Thailand, and Vietnam. So, obviously a wide swath of countries, most robust economies in the Pacific and in Asia. Some countries, obviously, we can see not there, but most of these are the countries that would have been involved in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, that was probably one of the biggest, maybe even the biggest in terms of work and effort project of the Obama administration. And I'm going to tell people that this agreement is not a good thing. It's not good to have an agreement with China in the middle of it, when we could have had one with the United States in the middle of it. And I hope I don't need to let people know that I'm not some flag waver for the United States by any means, and certainly not when it comes to neoliberal policies and these free trade agreements. That isn't my point. My point, rather, goes back to 2016 and the end of the Obama administration. The TPP had become a highly controversial topic. Donald Trump used the TPP as a campaign point and really rallied the populist right against it. And, it was one of the few things that, frankly, I agreed in principle, at least, with a lot of the opposition and a lot of the points even that Trump himself made, as disingenuous as they were, and they really, really were. People might also recall that by the time the election season was in really full swing, Hillary Clinton certainly no ideological opponent of neoliberalism, had changed her stance on the TPP and came out in opposition to it. And I think it was clear to everyone, and I don't think she tried to hide this, and it would have been very disingenuous if she had, that her basic point was, look, people, my voters don't want it. I don't think she ever really repudiated it in any way that was convincing to anyone or that really was intended to be. I don't think she wanted people to have the impression that she agreed with abandoning the TPP, but that, you know, she felt that, hey, you know, the people who support me are against it, and so I'm at least on the campaign trail, I'm going to also oppose it. So what you had was a pretty widespread opposition to the TPP. And I felt at the time, and I think the signing of the RCEP now kind of bears out my concern at the time, which was, you know, look, I was as opposed to the TPP as anyone else. I think Obama handled it very, very badly. Most of the talks and processes around the TPP were very opaque. People did not know what was being negotiated, and there was, you know, the track record of the U.S. and free trade agreements, and certainly this fit with Obama's essential neoliberal ideology, is that they were all about, you know, facilitating the making of money, the increase of corporate market share, and utter disregard for environmental, human rights, and worker rights concerns. That had been the history of free trade agreements. And it, you know, listen, there's no reason to think the TPP would have been otherwise. I do think what ended up coming out that we know about the TPP is that it had some token nods to those ideas, so more on the environmental ones than certainly on workers' rights and human rights. But there was something there. It wasn't much, but it was something. And from what I am given to understand from the RCEP, I haven't studied it intensely, but what I have seen of it indicates that there's even less of it in this agreement, which is, again, not surprising with China being the driving force behind it. Essentially, China picked up the tattered remains of the TPP and said, well, hey, if the United States is not going to do this, we'll do it. And, you know, we'll do it a little bit more in our way, but many of these, you know, many of the functional details are the same. So what you have now is a country, a massive economy at the center of this agreement that is even worse on those issues than the United States is. And this agreement reflects that. So how could that have been avoided? Well, the way I think it could have been avoided, I mean, a lot of the blame I do think has to go back to Obama's opacity in how he was constructing it. And I understand, I don't agree, but I understand his point of view throughout, which is that free trade agreements had gotten a bad name. And, you know, he really wanted, I think, to be able to implement the TPP and then say, see, look, this worked, before people could get all frightened of it. He was wrong to think that way, because all it did was increase opposition to the TPP to the point where we did, in fact, you know, pull out. And when Trump did pull out, this was not something that anyone objected to, because, you know, liberals as well had come to oppose it. So I think a lot of that has to do with Obama's way of handling it. But what we should have done as progressives was say, okay, the TPP, we're opposing the opacity of the process, but also, you know, we're saying, look, if we're going to have these sort of trade agreements, then they have to reflect environmental, human rights, and labor rights concerns. And this is what that looks like, and come up with a plan that actually does that, that is sellable, that you can get, you know, not necessarily China, but certainly countries like New Zealand, like Australia, like South Korea, a number of the countries that are now part of this agreement, that they could agree to. And I think that was possible. And we didn't do it. It's easy to oppose something. It's not always easy to come up with a realistic alternative. And then when we don't, you end up with, okay, the United States isn't responsible now for whatever harm this agreement may end up doing to workers, to human rights, and to potentially to the already, potentially world-ending environmental crisis. We may not be responsible, but okay, that seems to me cold comfort to the people who will suffer for it. So I think the lesson here is that, it's really, really important to not just oppose things, but to come up with alternatives. And that's harder. It's harder for us as progressives, too, because it's a lot easier for us all to agree on what's bad than on what we should do. And I get that. But I don't see how it's, how there's a better option. Because, when we talk about, for example, you see the slogan all the time, just to put it into something maybe a little bit more familiar for this podcast. When you see something, a slogan like U.S. out of the Middle East, I'm all for it. Great. But what does that mean? What does it mean that, we just stop being involved with anything and we just let everyone, just stop from this point on and just let the rulers, most of whom are there because of us, continue on along their merry way? Well, we saw the result of that with MBS, with Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia. We're seeing what happens. The United States did a terrible job in Libya, so let's get out of there. Okay, so the United States really, essentially destroyed Libya and then said, you're right, we shouldn't be involved anymore. And we basically left, and it's been chaos ever since. And it's in terms of regional instability, it's only getting worse. So we need to think about what that means. Does it mean that, we stop, fine, we stop giving aid to Israel? Does anyone seriously think that means that Israel's now going to turn around and end their occupation? If we are out, if we do nothing, where's the pressure going to come from? I mean, there's no pressure coming now, I agree. But lacking U.S. involvement, let's say Trump had not moved the embassy, had not had not done any of the things he did. He simply removed the United States from the equation. Given the damage we've already done, that would not have been helpful. It would have been harmful. I mean, this is the problem. The problem is when you do all this damage, when you follow these policies, then the result is that your mere absence then makes things even worse because you created those conditions. We have a responsibility to not just get out. We have a responsibility to at least try and set things right. And the problem is that is a foreign policy goal that doesn't necessarily follow all the time from what are our geostrategic interests. Though I would submit in many cases that it does. That is certainly my view, but we can debate that. What we can't debate is that there are things that are the right thing to do. And at some point, that has to be part of our policymaking. And I realize that people, consider that Pollyanna or naive. But, if we don't do that, then things don't get better. Disinvolving ourselves is not helpful. We end up with things being worse than they were even when we were involved. So that, to me, is the lesson of the RCEP. Again, I'm not advocating free trade agreements. I'm not advocating neoliberalism. I am advocating, and this is something that I think about in terms of, again, for example, Trump's determination to pull out of Afghanistan. I agree with pulling out of Afghanistan. I agree with that we should have gotten our troops out of Syria. I do not think you simply yank it away and let the chips fall wherever they're going to fall. We saw what happened in Syria when we did that. People on the left, many progressives, many of my friends were all like, yes, Trump's doing a good thing. And I'm like, no, Trump is not doing a good thing. In principle, the idea of getting troops out of Syria was a great idea, you know, and I completely support it. Doing it the way we did, you know, caused a massacre. That's not a good thing. And it increased instability. It cost lives. That's too high a price to pay for our policy goals when our policy goals are simply get the U.S. out. You know, in terms of when I say our policy, I mean progressive policy goals. I agree with that goal, but we cannot reduce that goal to do it at any cost. We have to implement those goals with some thought as to our responsibilities. Okay, so again, that to me is the lesson of the RCEP. It's a lesson of a lot of Trump's policies that occasionally were defended by some progressives. I think we need to think about that. And I think that's going to be really important going forward for the Biden administration. All right, I'm going to take a break. I'm going to come back and talk very briefly about Iran, and then we're going to move on to Mike Pompeo. Stay tuned. Okay, so on to Iran. And I had actually been thinking about talking about, I'm sure you all heard about Trump's misguided attempt to find a way to attack Iran. I would suggest that is not at all off the table, even though he got talked out of it temporarily last week. Then today I saw something that I think is going to be much more important going forward. And it was a statement by Democratic Senator Chris Coons, senator from Delaware. And Coons is somebody who is on the short list of candidates for Secretary of State in a Joe Biden administration. So his words here take on added import and added concern, I think. Coons basically was asked where he stood on re-entering the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal. And basically Coons said he would not support going back into the deal unless there were some other issues addressed. So we're back to this argument that was, you know, raging 5 and 6 years ago about getting the better deal and getting other things included in the JCPOA. Specifically, he mentioned Iran's ballistic missile program and short and medium range, their missile program in general, and also their use of regional proxies. I mean, so, okay. the stance coming from a Democrat, coming from somebody who was under consideration for Secretary of State, and particularly coming from somebody who is considered liberal, not, you know, certainly not Bernie Sanders liberal, but, you know, he's considered on the liberal side of the centrist, if you want to put it in some sort of scale. Coming from him, it's simply remarkable how not only hawkish this point of view is, but stupid and self-defeating. I mean, let's start from the point of just of pragmatism. It is manifestly obvious what a bad idea it was to pull out of the JCPOA. Look, many people who had opposed the JCPOA when Obama put it together, even people who opposed it, including Jim Mattis, said, okay, you know, yeah, we opposed it, but now that we're in it, you don't just pull out when the other side hasn't violated it, which in fact Iran had not. We had, by the way, that's the part that few people mentioned, because the whole point for Iran wasn't just freeing up the cash that that had been frozen in American banks for so many years. It wasn't just removal of the sanctions that were put in place specifically to get Iran to the negotiating table to negotiate over their nuclear program. It was supposed to, and this was part of the agreement written in black and white, there was supposed to be investment in Iran to help their economy recover. That was part of the deal. And not only did the Obama administration, we're talking the Obama administration here, not only did the Obama administration not encourage such investment, they themselves were not discouraging it, but they did nothing to stop members, Democrats even, and certainly many Republicans, from talking, basically, telling investors that, this deal may not hold, and, you know, we're still looking at maybe some other sanctions, this and that, and basically telling investors that their investments are not going to be safe in Iran. So, basically throwing cold water, not saying you can't do it in any way, just saying, you know, maybe it's not the best idea because we're going to do X, Y, and Z, and that might not mean that your investment is going to pay off. And the result was there was very little investment in Iran. That was with Obama. Okay. And since then, you know, now we've pulled out of the deal. We know that Iran is again, you know, enriching uranium. They're doing it right now, according to the IAEA. They're doing it only at lower levels. But even at the lower levels, they haven't, you know, they have enough enriched uranium that they conceivably could, within a few months, make a nuclear weapon if they so chose. That means they're closer to it by far than they were when the JCPOA was still in place. So, you know, and certainly nothing has happened to rein in any of the other so-called malign behavior of the Islamic Republic. So on every level, this policy has been a failure. We should be beating the door down once Trump is out of office to get back in this deal. That's just the baseline. It's the beginning. It by itself, it won't even fix the damage Trump has done in this regard, but it's the bottom line to start. And Coons, who, let's keep in mind, is somebody who might become the top diplomat in a Biden administration, is actually saying, well, maybe we shouldn't get back into that deal unless they can make it a lot better. Well, Senator, I hate to tell you, it was us who pulled out of that deal. It was the United States who showed bad faith. It was the United States who did not live up to our side of the bargain. It was the United States who left our allies holding the bag. And by the way, it was Iran who stayed, who tried to stay with the deal and continued to implement their side of it long after Trump pulled out, and only gradually started disregarding the provisions that were supposed to bind them in that deal as a way to try and convince either the United States to come to its senses or to convince the other powers, particularly Europe, to find a way around the United States' insane behavior in this regard. We've already been close to war with Iran, very perilously close once. And we're moving towards it again now, as we see with Trump's attempts to find a way to justify attacking Iran just a couple of weeks ago, not even a couple of weeks ago. So what Chris Coons is thinking here is beyond me. It is just frankly beyond me. This notion that first of all, Iran would be suicidally stupid to give up their missile program, to leave themselves defenseless with the Saudis, who hate them, right across the Gulf, with Israel, who is constantly threatening them within striking distance, and with the United States being so hostile to them, even under a democratic regime. So many Democrats are basically hawks on Iran. What rational? I mean, how derelict would they be in terms of protecting their own citizens, forgetting about any other political concerns? How derelict would they be in terms of protecting their own citizens to give up their missile program? It's and frankly, it's not going to happen. There is nothing short of finding some way to guarantee both Israel and Saudi Arabia will stop attacking or provoking or doing anything hostile to Iran. Unless you can do that, they're not giving up their missile program. It's crazy. They should, and they shouldn't, frankly. They'd be nuts to do that. And then when we talk about, proxies, obviously we're talking groups, the many militias that Iran backs, Hezbollah, as we know, some support for Hamas, although that's been inconsistent, especially in recent years. I understand the concern there. I do. But again, why should Iran agree to stop that behavior? And why is that behavior considered malign when Saudi Arabia does the exact same thing? So does the UAE. So do, other countries in the region back their preferred groups. So do the United States, all across the world. We've done it for many, many years. But somehow Iran is supposed to be in some sort of different category. And of course, the reason they're in a different category is that their agenda does not match ours. That's why. I mean, ultimately, that's really what this is about. Their foreign policy goals are in conflict with ours. And that's fine. And so what we, being as powerful as we are, try to do is stack the deck so only we can do certain things. And that's certainly not unique to Iran, that sort of hypocrisy and double standard. But there is no law against what Iran is doing. It's not illegal. It just is something that we do too. We don't like it when others do it. It's okay for us and for our allies, like the Saudis. The basis for Kuhn's complaint is absurd, and it's no less absurd now than it was 5 and 6 years ago, when most Republicans and far, distressingly far too many Democrats were making these arguments. What's most concerning right now is that somebody who's being considered as Biden's Secretary of State is making that argument. To me, this should be immediate grounds for disqualification for that job for Kuhn's. It is clear that this is that any cabinet position that has anything to do with foreign policy is inappropriate for a person who is this myopically foolish when it comes to foreign policy, presuming that Joe Biden, and I think it's fair to presume this, that Joe Biden is serious about wanting to tone down the tense state of affairs in the Gulf, wanting to rejoin the JCPOA and seeing where he can go from there. Look, I'm not saying that we cannot try and convince Iran to change its policies, to change its behaviors. If we want to try and hit talk about the missile program, fine. I think that's a dead end, because I think it is utterly unrealistic, and just a crazy sort of ask. But if you want to do that, hey, that's fine. You can talk about whatever you want, but if you're going to start implementing sanctions and putting that kind of pressure, the kind of pressure that kills people. Let's remember this: the so-called maximum pressure that the Trump administration has put on Iran kills people. a lot of people, especially now under the circumstances of COVID-19. Iran cannot get the medical equipment that it needs. It cannot get the drugs it needs. It can't do a lot of things on the international market because of Trump-imposed sanctions. So there's these things have real consequences. So let's keep that in mind. It's not just sanctions, and it certainly are not things, you know, no matter what Mike Pompeo says, certainly not things that just target the regime and are there defending the people of Iran, which is the most nauseatingly absurd Orwellianism that, you know, I can think of right now. And one expects this from the Trump administration. One expects it from the Republican Party. We cannot accept this kind of thinking from Democrats who are going to be in any way involved with foreign policy. I'm not talking about policing people's opinions, but if you're going to be involved with constructing the Biden administration's foreign policy, this is a sine qua non. You cannot get into this when you're going to obstruct the JCPOA. If Biden's doing nothing else on foreign policy, this has to be a clear priority. If someone's going to argue that somebody who would agree to re-enter the JCPOA will not get past Mitch McConnell in the Senate, that's fine. But then what's the point of getting someone past Mitch McConnell in the Senate if they're basically just going to be another Republican and are going to make the situation worse? Then you're better off not doing it in the first place. Anyway, so that was what I wanted to say about that. And can take one more very short break and come back and talk about Mike Pompeo and the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement. Stay tuned. Okay, back again. And yesterday I published a piece for Responsible Statecraft on Mike Pompeo's stop in Israel and the occupied territories. It's entitled Pompeo's Attack on BDS is an Assault on Free Speech. In this case, I wrote the headline, and it doesn't quite capture the essence of the story that I want to make very clear. That's on me. Because it's sort of obvious, right? I mean, at this point, I think most of us realize that these attacks on BDS, the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement, are just completely contrary to the notions of free speech. Legally, they're not going to withstand any sort of challenge in terms of the government cracking down on them. However, when the State Department labels something hate speech, it can't do anything to actually stop speech. Hate speech is protected under the First Amendment. So labeling BDS hate speech can't technically make it illegal, but I mean, the stigma is obvious, I think, you know, to all of us, what that means. And it also means that the State Department is compelled to make sure that none of its funds goes in any way to groups that support BDS. And we've seen that their definition of, quote unquote, support BDS can be very, very broad. And often means that if something that the State Department funds is also supporting in any way, like even holding forums or you know, anything at all, another group that is active in BDS, that would be enough to cost funding. So there can be real ramifications beyond the stigma of being labeled hate speech. So it certainly matters. I would also say that this is more of a concern than a lot of other late in the game Trump administration policies, because this is one that I think Biden is going to be reluctant to take on, certainly early in his administration, because this is a fight. I think you may find that even the Netanyahu government will support, albeit quietly, finding ways to restore funding to the Palestinian Authority so that it doesn't collapse, so that they continue their security coordination with Israel. That may not be good for Palestinians, but most people would see that as helping Palestinians. Most Americans would see it that way. Most Palestinians, I'm not so sure of, but most Americans would see it that way. So, and I think most Israelis would see it that way, Israeli Jews. And I think as a result, Netanyahu might quietly support it because it would be helpful actually to Israel. But anything about BDS, which has been so badly demonized now, is a real fight. And it's a fight among Democrats. Among Republicans, it's not a fight. You know, Republicans just all say it's you know, they hypocritically call it anti-Semitism, but what they really mean is they do not want to even allow criticism of Israel. That can be for evangelical religious reasons, or it can be for strategic reasons, or it can simply be a way, as I believe has been demonstrated recently in other countries, to attack the left. Because, you know, in general, bigotry is widely seen as the province of the right. And even though the left, I think most progressives will certainly admit that there's, you know, there's always racism, misogyny, homophobia, transphobia, et cetera, everywhere, regardless of political beliefs. The progressive movement tries very hard to address those things. I don't know that their ways of addressing them are always successful or always maybe the best ways, and you know, but that's always an ongoing conversation. Anti-Semitism is something that the right has weaponized as something that is almost, the way they would characterize it is that it really is a left-wing problem. You see this all the time on the left. They hate the Jews. So, you know, that stigma on BDS is a big deal. And it's impactful because, unfortunately, it's something that resonates. And there are certainly Jews who are otherwise liberal who do believe this. And again, it's kind of, because it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy, because it's based on the idea that criticism of Israel comes from anti-Semitism. In other words, the smart argument on the right is, not that criticism of Israel is ipso facto anti-Semitic, but that criticism comes from anti-Semitism. That it doesn't have to be anti-Semitic, but it is, because that's why people are criticizing such a noble country that never does anything wrong. Or when it does do something wrong, it's not really such a big deal. Yeah, I mean, you've held Palestinians without, you know, under military occupation without any rights since 1967. But what's the big deal? Could be worse. I mean, they didn't kill them all. Okay. I mean, you know, that's sort of like, you know, you assault somebody, you didn't kill them. So was it really a crime? Really? I think most would say yes, but okay. That's a different argument. But you see my point is that the stigma of so-called hate speech matters, and it has an impact, and it matters to liberals and it matters to Democrats. And so these things do make a difference. And as a result, because there's this divide and it's very real, within the Democratic Party, this is not something Biden is going to want to take on right away, because there's so much that he can do that Democrats are completely united around, including, you know, on this issue. You know, if he can find a way to restore funding to Palestinians, to UNRWA, to revive peace talks. Again, something I'm not sure Palestinians will be so crazy about, but Americans probably will. American liberals. And, these are things that he would prefer to do, because they're not fights, certainly among Democrats. So, you know, that's number one, is that Biden is not likely to reverse this. But I think there's a bigger point here. And I think the point is that it is fair and certainly true to defend the right of BDS, even if you disagree with it, on free speech grounds, right? Boycott is a protected form of speech. It is legitimate. And I think many pro-Israel liberal types, and I touch on this in the article, defend it in that way. As a matter of fact, I mentioned one person who I actually have quite a bit of respect for and I like, who I don't always see eye to eye with, but I do think is a very good person doing a lot of very good work, and that's Rabbi Joel Jacobs of TRUA, the Rabbinical Human Rights Organization, who says that the way to address quote-unquote distasteful speech is with more speech, not by criminalizing it. Okay, I mean, that point is certainly true, and I agree with it as far as it goes, but what is distasteful about BDS? What is distasteful about it? What is illegitimate? Because distasteful implies that it is somehow wrong, that it is somehow, whether it's rooted in bigotry or ignorance or whatever, that it is an inherently illegitimate point of view, and I don't see how that's defensible. I think it's defensible to disagree with BDS, to not support BDS, to oppose BDS, to say, you know, it's not appropriate to boycott Israel and make your case as to why. Okay. That's fine. Okay. But it's appropriate to boycott England over the issue of Northern Ireland. It is appropriate to boycott, certainly appropriate, I think, to boycott Morocco over Western Sahara and its occupation there. It is appropriate to boycott China over what it's doing now in Hong Kong, its treatment of Uyghurs. All of these things are appropriate. And if I choose, for example, to boycott Morocco, I do not then have to say, why am I not boycotting China? Because I choose, the answer to that question is simple. I choose to devote my energy to the issue of Western Sahara. And that argument that why are you picking on Israel? The reason that you pick on Israel when it comes to this is because it is holding millions of people without rights. And it is destroying their homes. It is assaulting them. It is, in some cases, killing them. It is making them live in unbearable conditions. People in Gaza have been under siege for years. They only have a few hours of electricity a day. They have almost no drinkable water. There is enormous unemployment because they cannot export. We can make a long list and just, you know, read years of, by the way, State Department. Even under Trump, the State Department has noted human rights violations here. But even and certainly before that, you had State Department reports. And then read Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, B'Tselem, Gisha, Hamoked, You know, and I'm listing here Israeli groups. I mean, obviously, the Palestinian Center for Human Rights or AHAC are going to have. I mean, the documentation here is legion. If you need that, but you don't need that, go to the West Bank. Forget Gaza for a minute. Go to the West Bank. You can see it. It is not hard to see. Okay. Walk through the streets of almost any Palestinian village in the West Bank. It's not hard to see it. Okay. These are problems. And again, you want to defend Israeli policies and say they're necessary? Fine. Defend them. Defend them. Say that Israel is taking necessary steps for its security and therefore you should not boycott it. That's a debate that you can have. I think you're wrong. That's fine, but you can have that debate. You cannot preemptively say Israel is somehow immune from boycott. And if you try to boycott Israel, you're an anti-Semite. That is crap. It is just garbage. And it's a tactic that is unfair and nonsense and filled with nonsense thinking, because you can't defend your own point of view. So you try and eliminate the ability of the opposing point of view to even be presented. Now, is that what Jill Jacobs is doing? Of course not. Is that what, you know, Jeremy Ben-Ami at J Street was doing when he makes similar statements? Of course not. These people are defending absolutely the rights of BDS activists to call for BDS. But by doing so on the basis of having to tolerate noxious speech, listen, I will defend, for example, on a free speech basis, there's a debate in this world, whether racists should be able to spew their racism, whether Nazis should be able to spew their anti-Semitism. And I say, as long as you're not inciting violence, you know, which you know is where we have traditionally drawn the line. And while I don't necessarily agree with a lot of American jurisprudence on this one, I'm in full agreement. If your speech should be free and protected until such point as you are endangering people's safety, that then is different. You know, if you're inciting lynching, then that's not okay. But simply expressing the point of view of that you're racist or a sexist or an anti-Semite or an Islamophobe, I think we have to, acknowledge that, people have a right to do that. Now, again, that's about government interference, which is what I'm talking about here. I'm talking about Pompeo. So I'm talking about, government interference in those things. We can socially stigmatize that stuff. And here and again is the debate we need to have. When is it appropriate to socially stigmatize? Is it appropriate to socially stigmatize a movement to boycott Israel over its treatment of Palestinians? And my answer to that is no, not if you believe in universal human rights, not if you believe in equality and in justice and in the idea that a Palestinian human being has the same rights as an Israeli Jewish human being. If you believe in those things, that does not, I am not arguing that means you have to support BDS and you have to agree with BDS and you have to say, that's different. That is a policy debate that you can have. Okay. But to say that somehow it is inappropriate to boycott Israel, and I mean Israel, okay, because in a lot of these cases, and I think people like Jill and Jeremy would agree, they're fine and agree and support boycotting settlements, which is another aspect of Pompeo's trip, where he said that from now on settlement products could be labeled as made in Israel. And they have a problem with that, and I agree with their problem with that, and I've written extensively about the problems with that. But in the end, the occupation is not a settlement policy. It is an Israeli policy. The denial of Palestinian rights is not the settler's policy. It is an Israeli policy. Most Israeli citizens, because 80% of the population are Jews, and certainly most Israeli Jews support those policies. Okay. These are Israeli government policies. They are not enacted in Ma'ale Adumim. They are not enacted in Efrat. They're not enacted in Tapuach, in Kfar Tapuach. They are enacted in Jerusalem. That's where that's where they come from. So it is entirely appropriate. Again, you don't have to agree with it as a matter of policy, but you do have to see it as completely appropriate to call for boycotts, divestment, and sanctions. People who know me have known for years, I have advocated economic pressure on Israel since the mid-1990s. I have said unequivocally, and I'll continue to say this, Israel will never change its policies because unless it has to, because Israel is a country. It is a state like every other state. No state gives up its power unless it has to. There is nothing special about Israel in this regard. Okay, there's nothing particularly evil about Israel in this regard. They are the same as every other state. It's one of the reasons I oppose the state system, but you know, let's not get too far ahead of ourselves. You know, any country does not give up power just to be nice. They do it because they have to. They do it because there's a demand. They do it because there's pressure. So I have, based on that, I have said since the mid-90s, there has to be pressure on Israel. And the only way that pressure is going to materialize is through economic pressure. So in principle, I support boycotts. I support, and I certainly support divestment and sanctions. I do not happen to support the BDS movement in its current iteration because I find it lacks a strategic center. I think it's too willy-nilly. I think things should be targeted. Whatever. I don't agree with the strategy of the way it's been enacted. That's for me. So that's a question of me supporting something or not supporting something. But this is a Palestinian decision. And if the and this is a Palestinian-led movement. And if this is what the Palestinians decide they want to do, and this is the way they decide to go about it, I absolutely support their right to make that decision without being called anti-Semites. Okay, it is not my call as to how Palestinians are going to conduct their liberation. It is my call where I want to put my support. Okay, but it would be completely immoral of me to then oppose what they're doing because I disagree with the tactic. You know, because I have a tactical disagreement. I'm not going to oppose it for that reason. And the other reason I might oppose something that they're doing is because it would be immoral. But it is not. It is extremely moral. This is the BDS movement is an alternative to violence. You know, most occupied people, including Palestinians for a long time and to this day, respond with violence. That's how, and sometimes it works. It has worked in the past. I do not think it will work in this case. I think most Palestinians come to the realization it will not work in this case. But beyond pragmatic issues, attacking civilians is just never okay with me. And in my experience with most Palestinians. So what's the alternative? Well, this is the alternative. You know, and the attempt to drown it out in calls of anti-Semitism is simply an attempt to cut off all avenues. For Palestinians to get what they want, because this nonsense that there's going to be bilateral talks that are going to achieve anything, it flies in the face of all logic and all history. Because again, as I said before, Israel is a state like any other. It does not simply do things to be nice. Any more than the United States does, Russia does, China does, Britain does, France does, whoever. Any state doesn't do things for that reason. They do things because there is a strategic political reason to do it. And usually it's a response to pressure. So expecting Israel in some way to be different from that is ludicrous. Okay. So what is the option for the Palestinians? What exactly are they supposed to do? They're not allowed to go to international forums, according to the United States. If they do, you know, things get cut off. If they go to UNESCO, the United States pulls out of UNESCO and pulls out its funding. So the United States is blocking that avenue. Now they can't call for boycotts because that would be anti-Semitic, apparently. So they can't do that. So what message are we sending Palestinians exactly? Violence is the only thing that's ever going to get you what you want? Is that the message we want to send? Because that's what we're saying, and that's what Pompeo's saying. Pompeo wants, and people like Pompeo want, to move this issue to the sphere of violence because Israel's capable of so much more than the Palestinians in this regard. And it's a way to presumably end the, you know, end the conflict, because the Palestinians really turned to violence in a way they never have before, popularly and on a widespread basis, Israel will decimate them and the world will support it. Is that what he's thinking? I don't know. I don't care. Because the only way we are ever going to get to a better place in Israel and Palestine, whatever your proposed solutions, 2 states, 1 state, 16 states, no states, I don't care, whatever your proposed solutions, the only way any of them ever work will be because there is some measure of justice. And I don't mean justice in the sense of restoring what happened in the past, but moving forward, that both sides have a future with dignity, with rights, with freedom, and with the same potential that the rest of the world has for prosperity. If that cannot be achieved, then there is no hope. And the only way that can be achieved is by treating Israelis and Palestinians as equals, which is exactly what Pompeo is standing against here. Okay. So when we say that we'll tolerate calls for BDS because, you know, we believe in free speech, we are implying that we are tolerating something that really isn't okay. How is it not okay? Again, you don't have to agree with BDS. You don't have to support BDS. You certainly don't have to engage in boycotts and divestment and sanctions against Israel if you do not want to and you do not believe it is the right thing to do. You can, in fact, oppose it and say, hey, Israel doesn't deserve this. If that is your point of view, fine, pursue it. Make that case. But calling BDS anti-Semitic is disgusting. Not only is it politically disastrous if you hold universal liberal progressive values. Not only that, it is an insult to every Jew who has ever suffered anti-Semitism. It's an insult to me and the times that I have been assaulted for being Jewish, that I've seen my family members assaulted for being Jewish. And yeah, that's happened. I grew up in New York City. And that happened to me on more than one occasion. Okay. For every Jew that has been killed, for every Jew that has been driven from their home over the years, it is an insult to throw this accusation against people who are trying to find a nonviolent way to stand up for their rights, which are being systematically destroyed. Their families are being killed. These are serious issues. And these are people, BDS activists are people who are trying to find a nonviolent way to address that. And if some of those people may in fact be anti-Semitic, that doesn't change a thing. It doesn't. You can, the merits of the case are still the same, just as the fact that supporters of Israel, some are anti-Semitic, whether that be Richard Spencer, whether that be John Hagee, whether that be Donald Trump. Okay. These are, or Yair Netanyahu. I mean, we can find many people, some of them Jewish, some of them Christian, some of them Muslim, yes, who are in fact people who hate Jews. Yeah, they exist. And some of those people support Israel. So does that mean supporters of Israel are anti-Semitic? Does that mean that I should call someone an anti-Semite because they believe that the settlements in the West Bank are a national right of the Jewish people, given to them perhaps even by God? I'm not going to call them an anti-Semite just because other people who think like them are in fact anti-Semites. And that is what this is. That is exactly what the argument that certain people who support BDS are anti-Semitic. Yeah, I've met BDS supporters who I know are anti-Semitic. And I've spoken out against them. And that has nothing to do with anything. No, the anti-Semites who support Israel and who oppose Israel do not characterize either side of this debate. And they do not delegitimize in and of themselves the positions on either side of this debate. Engage with the issue. It's that simple. Okay? And recognize that many people, this is, I think, important for all of us to remember, many people who support Israel do so because they really think it's the right thing. They really think it is morally right. They may not, some of them may not be aware of all the facts. Some of them may have miscontextualized some of the facts. Who knows? I mean, this is true about any issue that we can debate. Okay? Sometimes good people are misled, and some would argue that's what supporters of the Palestinians are. Okay, fine. Obviously, I would disagree with that, as I would disagree with the idea that every person who supports Israel is necessarily Islamophobic or hates Arabs or hates Palestinians or sees them as less than human, etc. There's a lot of reasons that people come to these positions. And we don't do anyone any good by trying to win the argument through stigma. Not to say that some of these people do not deserve to be stigmatized. An anti-Semite should be stigmatized for their anti-Semitism, but that should not be used to discredit anyone who shares other political views with them. Okay, if somebody is a racist and is also a fan of the New York Giants in football, I'm a fan of the New York Giants in football. Does that make me a racist? No, I think we could all agree that would be absurd. And yet that's what this argument is trying to do. Saying, well, some supporters of BDS are anti-Semitic. Yeah, and most aren't. Some supporters of Israel are anti-Semitic. Most aren't. So that part we can throw away, because and we need to throw it away. And we need also to pick up and hold close the idea that BDS activists are trying to find a nonviolent way to get Palestinians their rights. That's what BDS is. Debate it on that basis. It's either right or wrong to do that. It's either a good tactic, it's either the right tactic, or, you know, if you want to argue again that it's something that is inappropriate, it's too harsh a measure for Israel, make that argument. Just make the argument. It's that simple. But trying to call people who are fighting for equality and human rights anti-Semitic because of that fight is about as unethical as anything I can think of. So it's not enough to oppose Pompeo's actions here just on free speech grounds. Yes, they should be opposed on free speech grounds. We should make that argument, but that can't be the only argument. It can't. There has to be a basic respect. Zionists demand a respect for the idea that Jews can decide to constitute for themselves a nation. I happen to respect the idea that Jews can decide to constitute themselves as a nation. I'm not sure it's a good idea. I don't think it is. But that's a discussion for Jews to have among themselves. Okay. Our existence as a people, a community, a co-religionist, whatever that is for us to decide, just like it is for every other group. But we demand that people allow us to have that discussion. I mean, I know many anti-Zionists who say that this is, you know, you need to allow Jews to have that discussion. I don't think that should be controversial, as it should not be controversial for any group to make that decision for themselves. What that implies in the real world may be open. You know, that's where, obviously, if it impacts other people, that's when other people can then, of course, get involved. But since we demand that respect, I think Palestinians should also be given the respect that when they're standing up for their rights, especially in a nonviolent way, and this, you know, in a way that is time honored, you know, and certainly part of the liberal tradition, in many ways, that should be not just tolerated, that should be respected as legitimate, which doesn't mean it cannot be debated. It can. You can debate the point, but you cannot preemptively say that Palestinians are not entitled to this manner of activism, which is what people are intending to do. So Pompeo comes in and is trying to bully with the power of the government Palestinians and their supporters into silence, and is trying to bully his way into smothering BDS and simply defending BDS on free speech grounds isn't enough. It has to be defended as legitimate, even if you disagree with it. Okay, defending it as legitimate does not mean you agree with it. And that's not some tricky little nuance. It's not hard to communicate that when you're talking to people. And, you know, I think that has to happen. Otherwise, you're basically giving a certain legitimacy to Pompeo's argument. You're basically saying, yeah, you know, he's going too far, but there really is an issue there. And as long as you do that, it's going to be almost impossible to win this discussion. The idea that Democrats in any way support, again, they can, you know, they can all go on record and say, I don't agree with BDS, I don't support BDS. But the idea that Democrats in any way support even stigmatizing it is just wrong. To say that they disagree is fine. It's a political discussion. To say it, or it, because when you're stigmatizing BDS as in any way illegitimate, you are implying it is anti-Semitic. And that is unacceptable. All right. So I'm going to leave it there. And I will hopefully be back next week. I know I haven't been as regular on this as I'd like to be. Times are a little crazy. I'm sure everyone understands. But hope to be back next week. And again, check out my work at rethinkingforeignpolicy.org. Sign up for my newsletter at mitchellplitnick.substack.com. And remember to go to bookshop.org and pre-order what I think is really going to be a book you'll enjoy, Except for Palestine, by myself and Mark Lamont Hill. And I'm sure I will not be back before Thanksgiving. So stay safe and enjoy the holiday as best as you can. Bye now.